Good morning. My name is Mike Chibera. For those of you who don't know me, I'm one of the elders here at Grace, and it's my privilege to bring you session four of Men's Roundtable. I ask that we start with a clip from Cinderella Man, one of my favorite movies. It's the true life story of James J. Braddock, and he was a great man, a man that Joe Louis called the bravest man he had ever fought, a man who fought for his family. In the midst of great poverty that he endured. So it's a great story. I wanted to show that clip this morning because I know from talking to a number of you over the years, having lunch with you, breakfast and coffee and whatever, and as we've talked about work, I know that many of you, when you come home from work, you have felt like you have gone 15 rounds with a heavyweight contender. You've been battered and bruised by the trials of work. You've been had to deal with difficult bosses, difficult job assignments, travel, being laid off, and all kinds of other things. And so I know that you've been through the wars. You've been through the rounds. And so I thought it was a good intro for today. If you've been here for the first three sessions, you've heard about working in a fallen world. You've heard about the difficulty of that, and you know that from listening to our teachers that you can never expect that work is going to meet a need in your life or provide you with a level of satisfaction that only God can give you. That's been communicated very clearly to you. So does that mean that we get to spend half our waking hours doing something that has no meaning, that is meaningless and cannot give us a sense of purpose? Well, I would submit to you today that that's not the case, that in fact, it's just the opposite, that God does care about your work and that he does want you to find some sense of meaning, not the ultimate meaning and purpose, but that you can find meaning in your work. So the first, if you got your hand out, the first fill in the blank I've got for you this morning is to take our little formula we've been working with, that work does equal energy expended, but it does not equal energy wasted. Your time at work is not wasted. And hopefully today, by the time we're done, you'll see that there's some very practical ways that you can make sure that your time at work is not wasted. What I'd like to do today is bring you some hope, bring you some realistic hope. Jim Collins, in his famous book, Good to Great, interviewed Admiral James Stockdale. James Stockdale was a prisoner of war during the Vietnam War. He spent 8 years in a place called the Hanoi Hilton. When Collins interviewed him, he asked him, he said, you know, what was the secret of surviving that length of period of time? Because I know a number of people didn't survive. And he said, you know, the guys who didn't survive were the ones who thought they were going to get out by Christmas. The ones who had an unrealistic expectation. And so they would get their hopes up, and Christmas would come, and they wouldn't be released. And he said most often those prisoners would crash and burn. He said the key to survival was believing that you were in for the long haul, that it was going to be a long, grueling process being a POW, but that eventually you would win and you would be released. And so he had a term called hopeful realism. Hopeful realism. And it's a term that we're going to use today as we talk about work and redeeming work. If you came to Men's Roundtable and a man and his work believing that God was going to give you the ultimate dream job at the end of this and that work would be easy and you would wake up every morning looking forward to work, well, then you have not brought a realistic view to what work is really all about. But I do believe that in the midst of all the toil and in the midst of all the pain, that God can reach into your work world and touch your soul deeply in ways that will ultimately bring him glory. So that's what we're going to try to do today. Before we do that, I want to tell you a little bit of my story so that you'll know the perspective from which I come. When my father was 8 years old, the stock market crashed and the Great Depression hit in 1929. And he grew up in a very, very poor background. He was the son of Italian immigrants. He had five siblings, and his father made $24 a week and raised six children. His father was a carpenter in a factory. My father used to tell me about the poverty that he grew up in. I really couldn't get my arms around it because he didn't raise us in that environment, fortunately. But he would tell me stories about how he slept in a double bed with his other three brothers. And I can't begin to understand how he did that. They were all older than him. And I really, again, couldn't get my arms around what that must have been like. But when I was a young boy, I remember him taking his shoes off. And I looked at his feet, and he had these knots on his feet. And I didn't know what they were, and I asked him what those were. And he said, those are called bunions. If you've ever had a bunion, you know how painful a bunion can be. And I said, Dad, how did you get those? And he said, well, son, the doctor told me that that was a result of never wearing shoes that fit. And he told me he never had a pair of shoes that were his own until he was almost 20 years old, that basically he had worn the shoes that were handed down from his brothers. And as I've gotten older, I can relate to foot pain, and I imagine what he must have gone through. So he was the only member of his family to graduate high school. And then he, thanks to football, he was able to go on to college. And while he was a student at USC, World War II broke out. He went off to war, came back, and the GI Bill paid his tuition from there on out. And while he was still in school, he started working a job. He ran a retail establishment in the Five Points District of Columbia while he was still in college. He was all about work while he was running that establishment. A guy saw him and saw his selling skills and hired him to sell insurance for a company called Mutual of Omaha, where he worked for the next 50 years. But I grew up in this man's home, and he had a sometimes unhealthy perspective on work, which skewed my perspective. He was all about work. He was all about providing for your family because he had stood in a breadline with his family. So he made sure when I was a young boy that I would work a series of dirty jobs to make sure that I valued a college education. So he put me to work as a 12-year-old, and I continued on in a series of jobs. I was a busboy. I was a dishwasher. The worst job I ever had was working for a janitorial service. This janitorial service, our customers were bars. And what we had to do is get up about 4:30 in the morning every morning. We were done by 10 before they would open up, and we would clean bars after the night before. So basically, we cleaned vomit out of bathrooms. And that gave me a real appreciation for my need to get an education. So I go off to college, and somewhere in the midst of that college experience at Carolina, my dad says to me, he says, son, I don't care what you do, you just better have a job when you get out of college. And I knew he was serious. His buddies gave him a nickname several years ago. They call him the Godfather. And so I knew the Godfather was serious when he told me I better have a job. So I went to the guidance counselor at USC, and I said, how can I find a job? What's my best bet? And she said, accounting. And I said, sign me up. And so I majored in accounting, and that began what for me a 31-year career as a public accountant and business consultant. And so over the past 31 years, as I worked for the same firm, I had a lot of different experiences at work that I'll draw from as I share with you today. But I want you to know I can relate to where you're sitting. I had bosses I couldn't stand. I sat at work sometimes bored to death with what I was doing, not finding any meaning in it. I got passed over, got left out of things. I found myself unequally yoked with people I was working with as a believer. I found no meaning in what I was doing at times. I had to travel, and I hated that at times, to be away from my family. And my last job I had at work with the firm was I had 110 women reporting directly to me. And that job drove me to take their early retirement option. All that to say is that next to my family, next to my wife and kids, there's been no area of my life where God has touched the depths of my soul more than work, where he has shown me his grace and his mercy and his presence in my life more than work. And I believe with all my heart he wants to do the same for you. So what we're going to do today is we're going to get very practical as we kind of turn the corner and look at some very practical ways that we can redeem our work and bring some hope and some meaning into what we're doing. So we're going to look at 10 strategies for redeeming work. You'll see those in your outline. Several of these I drew from a list that Matt mentioned in his very first session. He gave you a quick list of 10 things. I'll pull from those, and we'll double-click on them and talk about them a little bit more. So let's start with number one. One of the ways that we can redeem work is by providing for your family. By providing for your family. There's a verse here from 1 Timothy which kind of challenges us, and it basically says a man who doesn't provide for his family is worse than an unbeliever. And you know, I know many times it's very tempting to say, as we're working and thinking about maybe the struggles of work, we'll make a statement like, you know, if it were just me, I would go do such and such. But for most of us, it's not just you. You've got responsibilities. You've got a wife. You got kids. You got bills to pay. And so you stay in the daily grind, and you put one foot in front of each other, and you go to work every day, and you pay the bills. I want to give you a perspective on that, particularly for some of you younger guys, which, looking back on it now, hopefully you'll find encouragement, as I was encouraged in this as I came to the end, because there were many days that the only reason I went out the door and got in my car and went to work was because I had to provide for my family. And I want to show you some of the beauty in that. So this past fall, my wife and I were asked to teach a class here at Grace called Legacy. And that was for half-timers, people who are kind of midlife, helping them find their spiritual passion for the second half of their life. And we began that class by sharing our own testimony. And I shared some of what I just shared with you about how I ended up in my job and all that. But my wife, as she shared her testimony, and I never really heard her say this directly until she said it that night, she said to this group, she said, you know, all I ever dreamed about was becoming a wife and a mother. And I wanted to stay at home with my kids and raise my kids. And thanks to Mike, who worked a job and provided for us, I was able to do that. And I'm standing there, and in that moment, all the crap that I had to deal with at work over all the years, it was worth every single bit of it to hear my bride say, hey, he made my dreams come true. Now, I know for many of you, your wife's dreams may be different. That maybe you're making sacrifices for so that your wife can work. That's not the point here. The point here is I want to give you some encouragement today and say to you guys who are out there, putting one foot in front of each other, going to work every day, punching the clock, paying the bills, supporting your family, you are God's heroes. You are God's unsung heroes. And I think it's one of the greatest ways that we redeem work is by, as we say in Men's Roundtable, rejecting passivity, accepting responsibility, and providing for your family. Don't ever diminish that. And I hope you can have an experience like I had one day where you hear your wife say, hey, you made my dreams come true. Number two, skillful and excellent work glorifies God. Skillful and excellent work glorifies God. Even God, when he created the world, Genesis 1:31, looked at what he did and he said, it was good. Admit it, guys, there is something about doing a job well that gives you a sense of satisfaction that's really, really cool. Where you created it, you did it, and you have that feeling. That was good. And when you do it well, skillful work. I've been blessed by skillful workers. I've also been very frustrated by those who were not skillful. I know many of you could say the same thing and could tell stories about how a doctor, a plumber, a lawyer, an insurance agent, somebody, because they did their job well, was a blessing to you. When we bought our house that we live in about 20 years ago, it was a 30-year-old house, and so it needed a lot of work. And so I had to hire a lot of different people to do a lot of different things. And I had some guys do some work who claimed to be Christians, and their work wasn't fit for the devil. But on the other hand, I did have some guys who did some work that truly for me, even looking back on it, was kind of a worshipful experience. So when we bought our house, I didn't have a lot of requirements to our house. I had one requirement, and that was that we have a big driveway. Because I wanted to make sure that with my three boys, we'd have a place to have family basketball games on a regular basis. So we bought this house. The driveway met my criteria, but it was in bad shape. And it needed to be re-poured. At 30 years old, you couldn't even bounce the ball in places. And so I asked a friend of mine here at church if he knew a good concrete man. And he gave me the name of a guy who he said was the best in the business. And so he came out, and he undersold and over-delivered. He said to me before he poured the concrete, he says, Mike, you need to know that one thing in my experience working all these years in concrete is that concrete will crack. And so I'm not making you any promises that your driveway won't have some cracks in it at some point. Well, the other day I walked out in that driveway, 18 years after the fact, where this guy poured that concrete, he professed to be a believer, and I could not find one crack in that driveway. Not one crack. It's amazing. And I'll tell you, when I walk through that driveway and see that, it is a worshipful experience for me because a guy did his work with skill, with excellence, and he did it to the glory of God. And I think that's what God calls us all to do. And when we do it, we can redeem our work. Number three, along the same vein, finding God's favor through diligence. One of the ways we redeem work is finding God's favor through diligence. Proverbs 22:29 says, "Do you see a man diligent and skillful in his business? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men." And some of you could probably give testimony today how God has helped you find favor in the workplace, where you've gotten an unexpected raise, an unexpected promotion. Maybe you've sold your business and been blessed by that. Whatever, maybe you picked up a new client, a new sale, whatever it is, but you found favor. Well, what is the catalyst for finding that favor? This verse tells us that it's diligence and skill. It's obedience. It's doing the things that God calls you to do in the workplace day after day, so that in God's perfect timing, His perfect grace, He can elevate you to the perfect place where you need to be, and you can find favor. This concept of being diligent and finding favor was shown to me at a very young age. When I was 15, 16 years old, I had this job bussing tables and washing dishes in a restaurant that was part of a hotel here in town. And it was a dirty job, but it was a good job, and I worked hard and tried to be faithful and obedient to what I was called to do. And about the time I was 16, the owner of the hotel came to me and he said, "Mike, we want to offer you a new position." And I said, "What was that?" And he said, "We want you to be the assistant to our maintenance man at the hotel." And that sounded a whole lot better than bussing tables and washing dishes. So I said yes. And he handed me a key ring that had a master key to 256 hotel rooms, a restaurant, a bar, and then he handed me a key to a company car. I was 16 years old. I think he was crazy at the time. But, you know, in any event, it showed me that by punching the clock, doing what I was told to do, doing whatever extra they asked me to do, that he saw something in me, and he said, "This guy's diligent, and I'm going to give him an opportunity." So I became the maintenance man that summer for the hotel, and I can remember looking at my buddies, and they'd be in there bussing tables, and I'd be out vacuuming the pool, getting a suntan. It was a pretty cushy job. Well, I don't know if that was standing before kings, but for me, it was definitely an elevation, and so I learned that lesson. When I was trying to make partner in the firm that I worked with for so many years, one of my bosses gave me a great piece of advice, because I was worried that if I was qualified, how they would ever find me. And he said to me this, he said, "You keep your head down, you do what you're supposed to do, you do your work well, you do what we ask you to do, and we will find you. I promise you, we will find you." And I think what God's kind of saying to me in this, through this verse, is do your job, do it well, and God will find you. God will find you in His perfect timing and put you in the place you need to be. Number four, work shapes your character. Work shapes your character. The word character is derived from a Greek word which means to stamp or engrave, which implies that character building is a process that occurs over time. It doesn't happen overnight. It's a slow process as your soul gets stamped with this character over time. I believe that work is the God-ordained crucible for building character. It's a laboratory, if you will, an incubator for how we build our character. There's no better place for us to try and work on our character. But what happens so often is that we're quitters by nature, and we don't give work a chance to allow God to use it to build the character that He wants to build in each one of us. So if you look at this verse in 1 Peter, it talks about slaves and masters. That's a modern-day equivalent to bosses and employees. It says, "You who are slaves must accept the authority of your masters with all respect. Do what they tell you, not only if they are kind and reasonable, but even if they are cruel. For God is pleased with you when you do what you know is right and patiently endure unfair treatment. It's so easy to get in a difficult work situation, working for a difficult boss, and just give up. And what Scripture's saying, well, that's not an excuse. That's not an excuse. You're supposed to hang in there and accept the God-ordained authority of your boss. And so I talk to a lot of guys who are thinking about changing jobs. And there are lots of good reasons to change a job. I'll give you that. Better opportunity. Somebody asked you to do something in your current employer that's not ethical, not in line with your faith. Lots of good reasons. But I'm going to give you a couple reasons that are not good reasons to change jobs. And unfortunately, I run into this sometimes. The first reason is you never want to change jobs when your unhappiness with your current job, when your displeasure with your current job is due to your own lack of diligence or skill that you're applying in the work. So if it's due to you slouching off and not doing what you're called to do, you need to really unpack that and make sure that that's not at the root of why you're unhappy. And then secondly, and I see this a lot, it's an unwillingness to submit to the God-ordained authority of your boss. God has ordained work, and he's ordained it to be used for his purpose. And just like he puts the church in authority over you, he puts your boss in authority over you. But so often we rebel against that authority, and we want to change jobs. Here's what I tell guys most of the time when they're thinking about jobs, because it's not a right or wrong decision. It's a right or left decision when they're thinking about changing jobs and they're waiting for God to speak to them about, hey, I want you to take that job. Sometimes that happens. But God cares less about where you work and more about how you work. God cares less about where you work and a whole lot more about how you work. Number five, integrity is your megaphone for evangelism. Integrity is your megaphone for evangelism. Integrity is a word that gets often overused in our world today. When anybody talks about the qualities of a leader, usually integrity is at the top of that list. Things that people respect in people is integrity. A lot of different definitions we can give, but one of the best definitions I heard this summer, I was in a meeting with a group of guys here at church, and a guy was talking to us about integrity, and he share this definition, which I'll share with you. You know the word integrity is derived from the mathematical term integer, which is used to describe whole numbers. And so if I give you three numbers to add up very quickly, 4, 6, and 8, most of you in this room could add those numbers very easily. It'd be very easy for you to do. Now I'm going to give you three more numbers and ask you to add them up quickly. 3/16, 4/12, and 7/9, okay? Unless you're Rain Man, you're probably not going to add those up very quickly, right? And so this guy went on to explain. He says what integrity is, it relates to a wholeness of a person that leaves no mystery in your mind. It doesn't leave you scratching your head. And so a person with integrity is not a person who, when they walk out of your office, you're thinking, what was that? What was that all about? A person who lacks integrity is like that person, you know, in work who says, you think of him, you say, well, you know, I know he goes to church, but did you see how he treated that customer? Did you see what he did on that invoice and how he billed them? And you're like, you can't reconcile that. It's not easy to get your arms around. Or the guy who, you know, I know he's married, but, you know, did you see the way he talked to his secretary, the way how much time he spends with her? I can't reconcile that. I can't make sense of that. There's not this ability to just see a consistent and whole life. And so I believe it's integrity that allows you in the workplace to be an effective ambassador for God. Integrity is winsome. People are drawn to it. When they see that, when they see a life that adds up and is consistent, then they want to know where you're coming from. And I believe with all my heart that God gives you opportunities to speak on his behalf when you work with integrity and when you have a life built with integrity. So integrity is your megaphone for evangelism. God will give you those opportunities if you'll be committed to it. Number six, another way that we redeem our work is by having the opportunity of doing what you were born to do. Doing what you were born to do. Doesn't happen every day, but I do believe that we get glimpses of God's glory in the workplace when he does allow for our gifts to intersect with our work. Sometimes I would come home from work on rare occasion, but I would come home and my wife would look at me and she's like, you don't even look tired today. What did you do? And I would get to tell her that on that particular day, I felt like I got to do what I was born to do because there was this intersection of what I was doing with the gifts that God had given me. And it's the coolest thing in the world when that happens. And I believe God allows that to happen on occasion for sure. It doesn't, getting to that point, I want to make sure you understand, doesn't happen overnight. I had very little awareness at 23 what I was particularly good at. And at 53, I'm just beginning to understand where my sweet spot is. So it's a process, but when it happens, it really does bring redemptive value to the workplace. I think one of the challenges in getting to that place is that so many of us, myself included, are not the most self-aware of what we're really good at. We think we're good at things that we're not, but in reality, you know, we're not as good as we think we are. And the ultimate test of what our true giftedness is public opinion. Simply, you know, being aware of when other people are blessed by whatever it is we're doing. And if people aren't being blessed by what we're doing, then chances are that's not your area of giftedness. So it's a great question to ask. Are others being blessed by what I think I'm good at? Let me step outside here for a minute and digress on something that I want to address, because I know in my life, and this may not relate to all of you, but for some of you, I think it will relate. I know I've had enough discussions with you to know. But there were days when I was on the job when I would say something like this to God. I would say, God, if you could just allow me to have a job in ministry where I could work for you full time, I promise you, God, I don't care what I was paid, I would serve you and I would serve you diligently. And I don't know if any of you have ever had that. You almost lost you there. It's a thought that is a little bit dangerous. And let me give you three things that when you have that kind of thought, you need to make sure you're not falling into these traps. The first is this, is that having a thought like that is a result of what I call vocational guilt. I read that term recently and it made sense to me. Vocational guilt is the belief that your job in the marketplace is less of a calling than a ministry job, that it has less value than someone who's called to full-time ministry. And that, guys, is not biblical. There's nothing in your Bible to support that. And in fact, your calling is of equal or greater value as anyone who works full-time in ministry, because you have the opportunity to reach folks, to have influence on folks that the average pastor will never get the opportunity. So make sure you're not thinking that your job in the marketplace is any less value. The second thing is that so many of us are very naive about what it is to really work in ministry and what all that involves and how difficult that is. And unless you've never worked in it, you can't fully understand the pain and the frustration of working in ministry. Think for a moment about having to go to church where you work. You know, for me, when I was working in a marketplace job, it was a great relief to come to church. But think about never being able to separate those worlds and all that goes along with that. Think about having a wife who would say to you, and I know many ministers' wives have said this, honey, if you just could get a job anywhere but in ministry, I would be so thankful. I would feel like I was so free. So don't be naive about what may really go on in the difficulty there. And then the last thing I would caution you about is most typically, if you're wanting to work in ministry, and many of you will eventually probably do that, but what works best is if you want that, if you want to be paid to do a ministry job, start doing it for free. God typically is going to call you to do something in a full-time way if you're already doing it without being paid. It's just a natural progression. So be willing to do that. Most frequently, he won't call you to that full-time job unless you're already doing it. There is no perfect job out there. Yes, many times we get a chance to do what we're born to do. But again, if you're looking for that perfect job, I thought I had a friend who had the perfect job. A guy I went to high school with, he ended up playing baseball professionally, and I thought he had the perfect job. When I caught up with him many years later, he was pitching for the Chicago Cubs. He was a middle reliever, pitched maybe an inning or two a night, every other night or so, and they paid him $1 million to do that. So I met up with him one time in Chicago after a game, and we went out and sat down, and I looked at him, and I said, you know, Bob, I think you've got my dream job. As a kid, I dreamed of having this job, pitching in Wrigley Field, you know, making that kind of money to do something that was so fun. And he said, stop, Mike. And he was a believer, and he said, Mike, it's just a job. It's still just a job. And he began to tell me about the headaches and the hassles of even that profession and all the travel and the time away from family. And he said, it's just a job. At some point, that's what it is. So be careful about idolizing perhaps that dream job that you might get someday. Number seven, make money so you can be generous. Another way we redeem work is by the reality that it allows us to make money so that we can be generous, so that we can understand the joy of generosity, the joy of being able to help someone, that feeling you get when what you've been entrusted with, you're able to share that with someone else and see the joy that that brings them. There's a feeling unlike any other. And so when you get that raise, when you get that bonus, when you sell your company, you make a bunch of money, that's okay because it allows you to be generous and experience that joy. When our kids were small, we'd like to give them a $20 bill around Christmas time and said, your only job is to give this $20 away. All you have to do is find someone who needs it and give it away. So we watched as they would enjoy that process. And one of our sons kind of was running out of time. And on Christmas Eve, we went to one of the few restaurants that were open on Christmas Eve with our family. We went to Waffle House. And I watched my young son, with that $20 bill, decide that he was going to leave it as his tip for the waitress. Nice tip for the waitress at Waffle House. And so we went out to the car and we're peering through the window at this waitress as she picks up this $20 bill. And she gets this big smile on her face. And that did not even compare as I looked at my son and saw the smile on his face that it put on his face to see what it did for her. The joy of generosity. It's one of the ways we're able to redeem work through the compensation that we get. Number eight, take Jesus to work. Take Jesus to work. It's so easy, guys, and I know I was so guilty of this many times in my own job, to leave Jesus at home, to leave him in the car, but to not bring him fully into my work environment. And so we create this dichotomy of thinking that, you know, Jesus is great for Sunday, he's great for, you know, small group or whatever, but the thought of bringing him into my business, into my job, well, this is what I do. This is what I know. But, you know, I don't really need him for this. And that is such a dreadful mistake, and a mistake that leaves us shortchanged and shorthanded in the workplace. Those of you who know me know that I love to read, and I'm a big student of leadership and understanding leadership concepts. I've read a lot of biographies, and basically I've concluded over the years there's not one great leadership idea, there's not one great leadership technique that doesn't come from the Word of God, or that specifically I couldn't trace back to the leadership genius of Jesus Christ. There has never been a greater leader, a more effective leader, a more powerful leader than Jesus Christ. And the more we understand about his life, the more we see application in what we do. And we could talk about servant leadership, which people have talked about a lot. You could talk about a lot of different things. But just I want to give you one sort of obscure implication of understanding the life of Jesus that applied to me in a situation that you may not have thought. So I got a verse here, John 2:15. Says, Jesus made a whip from some ropes and chased them all out of the temple. If you know the context for that verse, Jesus went to the temple. He saw the money changing that was going on. He was upset for his father's sake, and he drove all these men out of the temple. And people like to use that to say, yes, see, even Jesus got angry. Well, you know, what I want to focus on in this verse, and it's something that helped me when I had to come to a place in the workplace where I had to fire somebody. I remember the first time I had to do it, and thinking, you know, what would Jesus have to say about this? You know, how could it be done? Well, to me, this is Jesus firing somebody. He's cleaning house. He's firing a bunch of people all at once. He's running them out for a good purpose. But the thing that caught me as I studied this verse was the very first phrase. It says, Jesus made a whip. Well, the translated word there is he fashioned a whip. And so I can picture Jesus coming into the temple, not so much in a fit of anger, driven totally by emotion, but sitting at a table, realizing what he had to do, taking some strands of leather and fashioning and molding together and creating a whip that he was going to use for his purpose, which tells me there was some thought, some planning that went into that. And so I needed to take that same sort of discipline into what I was getting ready to do and having to terminate somebody from their job. There had to be a thoughtful process. I couldn't do that just because I was mad at him or just because I was tired of looking at him. I had to put some thought into it. And so regardless of the area, Jesus wants to be a part of what you're doing. He told some fishermen who thought they knew everything about fishing how they could fish more effectively. He wants to do the same for you. One of the most practical ways we can do that is through prayer. Making sure that throughout our day, not just in the morning, but right before you're going to get that phone call that you're dreading, that you give God a chance to speak into that, that you have that moment of prayer. So make him a part of your entire day. When I was just gotten promoted to partner in our firm, my first year as a partner was one of the worst years of my life because I said yes to too many things. I'd taken on too much responsibility, and I got in some situations that were very, very stressful. And I remember going up to see a client in Charlotte, and this is a client that I had inherited from someone else, and I realized pretty quickly that we had made a mistake in the prior year, and we were going to need to restate their financial statements, which was a big deal for them. It was going to cause them to be in violation of some debt covenants, and it was going to be kind of a difficult thing. So I got to be the bearer of that bad news. And I had to sit in a meeting with the CFO and the CEO, and I'm sitting there telling them about what we're going to have to do. And the CEO got very angry at me. And he stood up out of his chair. He was an older man. I was younger at the time, and he pointed this bony finger at my face, and he said, "Mike, I want to tell you something." He said, "You either fix this, or I'm going to sue your firm." And he looked right in my face, and he said, "I'm going to sue you for everything you're worth." And I said, "Can I get back to you on that?" And so I got in my car, and I drove back to my office in Greenville. And I remember my hands were shaking on the wheel. I thought I was going to have the shortest tenure in the life of any partner in our firm. And I remember driving just outside of Charlotte, and I saw this steeple at Belmont Abbey College. And I pulled off the exit, and I went into that chapel, and I got down on my knees, and I prayed one of the most desperate prayers of my life. And I said, "God, I'm here. You know exactly where I am, and I need you like I've never needed you before." And in that moment and through that situation, God showed me he wanted to be a part of my work. And he delivered me from that. We didn't get sued. We didn't even lose the client. It all worked out. But God was so graceful and merciful to me in that, which showed me there's no situation that he doesn't want to be a part of. Take Jesus to work with you. Number 9, transferring skills between work and ministry. Transferring skills between work and ministry is another way that we bring redeeming value to our work. I wish I could give you a verse for this, and all I've got to give you is personal testimony. And I will say to you, everyone here in this room, that if you're a gifted communicator, if you're a gifted marketer, salesperson, if you're a gifted administrator, and you are not using those gifts effectively for the kingdom, for God, then you are shortchanging yourself in both environments. Because what I found in my life is the more I shared abundantly for God's purposes, whatever gifts he had given me, the more he seemed to bless me in both worlds. There was this crossover blessing. Something would happen at church or in a ministry I happened to be working in that related directly to what I was dealing with at work. So don't miss the opportunity for that incredible crossover blessing of using your gifts holistically in both worlds. If you're that guy and you're saying, "Well, just wait, God. Wait till I get that promotion. Wait till I get to the certain status. I'll have more time then." You'll never have more time. Don't wait. Use your gifts for him in both environments and watch how he blesses that. Number 10. And I'll have to explain this one a little bit. Don't miss the Shechem moments. Shecham. Don't miss the Shechem moments. And I have to explain this to you from Joshua chapter 24. And what I want you to see is that one of the greatest ways that we can bring redeeming value to our work is by recognizing those situations where God has been faithful to us, taking note of them. So Joshua chapter 24, he's dealing with some disgruntled Israelites who are not thankful for all that God has done for them. And so I'm going to read just a few verses from that section that begins with verse 1. And take special note to the pronoun that I will emphasize. Joshua chapter 24, verse 1 says, Joshua summoned all the tribes of Israel to Shechem. Goes on to talk about who is there, including the elders and the leaders and the judges. And Joshua said to the people, this is what the Lord God of Israel said. So now he's going to speak on God's behalf. He says, long ago your ancestors lived beyond the Euphrates River and they worshipped other gods. But I took your ancestor Abraham from the land of the Euphrates and led him into the land of Canaan. I gave him many descendants through his son Isaac. To Isaac, I gave Jacob and Esau. To Esau, I gave the mountains of Seir. And then it goes on in the end, verse 13 says, I gave you land you had not worked on. I gave you towns that you did not build. What I want you to see here, guys, is that in your workplace, so often, God wants you to hear him say, I did that when you received that blessing. I had a lot of different moments in my life that I could call Shechem moments. Some, unfortunately, that I missed because I was thinking that I did something without realizing what God had done. So I'll share one with you. It happened to me about 5 or 6 years ago. And I need to tell you up front, I am not the smartest guy in the world. I am not the most gifted guy in the world. It took me forever to pass my CPA exam. Guys out of college passed that first time. For me, it took me multiple times. So I'm not some whiz. Twice in my career with my firm, I did what most people would call corporate suicide. I did something that in a large-scale organization, you don't typically do once and get away with it. I turned down an opportunity to move to another city and take another job and be promoted, and I didn't turn it down once. I turned it down twice for a variety of reasons. One of them came to me within a week of bringing my family to Grace Church in 1998, and I just was like, you know, it just doesn't feel right. I'm supposed to move to Chicago or Orlando or wherever they wanted me to move. And so I turned it down not once but twice, and most people would have said, well, that would have been the kiss of death. You know, how could you survive that? And so I worked for a large firm in one of their tiniest offices. Greenville, South Carolina is just a dot on the map for most of the people in our firm who are from large cities like New York, Chicago, and so forth. But God blessed me in so many ways that I realized there's no way I could have orchestrated this. So I'm sitting in New York City about 5 years ago, and I'm sitting in our offices at 5 Times Square. And I'm in this room there for a meeting where I had been elected by our partners to serve with 22 of my colleagues on an esteemed advisory council that was designed to provide advice to our CEO on how to run this $3 billion company. And I'm sitting in this room and I'm looking out the window thinking, what am I doing here? How did this former busboy who couldn't pass the CPA exam, who worked in this office that, you know, most people didn't even know existed, how in the world am I sitting in this room with people who are way smarter than me, who are from cities much larger than me, and I'm supposed to give advice to our CEO? How did that happen? And as I looked out the window and looked down Broadway in New York, I heard God say to me, Mike, I did that. I did that. And I believe, guys, that if you will be attentive to God in your work environment, you will find those moments where you just say, you know, I can't explain this. How did this happen? Don't miss those opportunities. Don't miss those opportunities to experience God's, the fullness of God's grace and his faithfulness in the workplace. Let me leave you with two thoughts and let you go to your groups. The first thought is simply this. That your work does matter to God. He cares about your work, and he wants you to invite him in to allow him to be a part of what you're doing. And when you do that, watch how he will bring redemption and value to what you do. So bring him in. He does care about where you spend the majority of your waking hours. And then the second thing, just to be mindful of all of you, to all of you as believers, to be mindful of whose representative you are in the workplace. A father, one of his heroes growing up, and he saw him play many times living outside of New York City, was a baseball player by the name of Joe DiMaggio. DiMaggio was a great Yankee Clipper, 56-game hitting streak, Hall of Fame baseball player, legendary player. I used to listen to my dad tell stories about DiMaggio. So when I got older, I read some books about him. And one of my favorite DiMaggio stories occurred late in his career. Yankees had clinched the pennant. Game didn't mean anything. Fly ball gets hit to center field. DiMaggio goes all out to catch this fly ball, almost to the extent of maybe injuring himself. He's back in the dugout after he does that. And a young player on the team says, "Mr. DiMaggio, I just want to ask you a question." And he said, "Sure, kid." He said, "What is it?" He says, "Well, that fly ball, you know, really, you kind of went all out for that. You know, we have clinched the pennant. Wasn't that big a deal? I just want to know why you gave that much effort." And he looked at him and he said, "Kid, two things you need to understand." He said, "One, I'm a New York Yankee. I wear the pinstripes. That's who I represent. Number two," he said, "there might be somebody up in the stands today who had never seen me play. And I would never want them to think that Joe DiMaggio would ever loaf." And so I thought about that, and I thought about the verse in Colossians 3:17 says, "And whatever you do or say, do it as a representative for the Lord Jesus Christ." You know, most of us will never get to wear the Yankee pinstripes, but we have a Savior whose body was striped on our behalf, and that is who we represent in the workplace. Live a life in the workplace that's worthy of the calling that's been placed on you. Let me pray. Father, I just thank you for the opportunity to talk about how ways that you can redeem our work. Work is tough in a fallen world, but I know it's not meaningless. I know it has purpose. So I hope that you'll give us insight and wisdom and know how to apply these strategies we've talked about so that we can experience the fullness of your glory even amongst a broken, fallen workplace world. In your precious and holy name we pray. Amen.